Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show.
All right, we're back with the pre-Thanksgiving podcast.
Yes.
Post-BGG, pre-Thanksgiving, that's how I measure time.
And we have like a slight timeline to follow today, so it's going to be like a tighter knit.
Right.
Fierce and furious.
Yes.
Not
for
fast.
Sure.
It's not a copyright issue.
That's a trademark.
Fierce and furious, podcast.
Yes.
We're going to come at you the way Rocky does in round 8.
Whereas it's a fierce and slightly angry.
So that means we're all off-brand characters from the... So are you Van Diesel?
He's Doom.
He's Doom.
I am dominant.
This podcast went to a weird place. All right, so let's start by reminding people, White Elephant gifts are going still.
Yep.
$20 for games originally 30 to 40. $30 for games for 50 to 70. They're pre-wrapped. You just buy that. You got a gift you can put right under the tree,
yeah.
Or give to some gamer nerd you don't know that well, or throw into the mix of a staff White Elephant gift and be like, hey, you guys should play board games now.
Yeah, trick them.
Trick them into board gaming.
We're already. I moved some just this weekend.
We got some Kickstarters in this week. We got Vast Grim, which is a Morkborg-powered
RPG
that is sort of cosmic horror space,
yes.
Warhammer 40K alien.
Yeah, I have yet to figure out like if it corresponds too closely with any of that stuff, but I would say those things, what was that video game?
Dead Space.
I would say your influences on it. There seems like there may be a little bit of a streak of like dark humor in there too.
Yeah.
And I'm probably going to pick it up because I've been picking up all the Morkborg stuff there. I love these are some of the funnest books to look through. They always have good visuals. They're real, like, kind of, they have that acid color style,
yeah.
But it's also, like, on good paper and all that. And some of the funnest character creation, as we have...
I mean, it's a little
Nick
bit of nostalgia of, like, the 80s rolling, like, roll on tables to build your character.
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of TMNT.
Yep, TMNT, or, I forget what some of the other ones... I want to say Rollmaster, because it's not... It's actually Rules Light. It's actually... These use, like, the OSR style, or early D&D style.
Yeah.
But you will be rolling for things like, you know, what random stray items does your character have in their pockets? Oh, what's their weird character quirk? What's their driving motivation? It's all kinds of fun stuff like that will give you some truly flavorful and weird characters.
Yeah. Do you have a stock of Twinkies that are
right,
much
Twinkies
sought after?
That is literally one of the things you could have in this weird dark future is... they call them like cream-filled sponge cakes,
yeah.
Or something like that. But it is clearly Twinkies, which I believe, if nothing else, can fetch you like a high price in their dark future market.
Right, commerce is based on Twinkies. and yeah, this is the Vast Grim is the core rulebook. We also got the three new expansions, which give you new classes and new characters.
Yep.
One of which was Space Clowns.
Yep. What's weird is like that and the Twinkies make it sound like this game is just a completely wackadoo game. But
no,
I believe it's actually like more like I think it's more like Dead Space if that had some occasional options for some lighter weirdness.
Yeah. There's also an adventure and a GM screen and a quick start guide. There's all kinds of stuff.
Because it's that OSR style, they have like I saw in some of the adventure ones, they'll do like a classic like essentially a dungeon crawl, but it'll be like a spaceship or a derelict or something like that.
Right, right.
And I did hear one time somebody talking about the advantage of OSR and old school games like that, which is that anybody can run a dungeon crawl. It's a good first kind of thing experience for somebody to do as a DM. You just literally describe what's in the room people walk into, and so it's one more cool thing about those options.
We also got the role playing game for Return to Dark Tower. That board game has been very successful, and it's got a cool world. It's got a cool, like, monsters and classes and that kind of stuff. And this is the RPG version, which is built on Mazes, the polymorph system, which is another sort of classic, D&D system.
I'll need to flip through that.
But I guess the deal with this is that each player selects one polyhedral die to represent their character and narrates actions to the maze controller, the DM.
Uh-huh.
The DM may then request rolls against a chart of moves You roll your one die, comparing your outcome against success numbers list for each move type. And it's sort of different die sizes are likely to be different forms of success. So it's like you have all the dice, but you're like, I'm using a D12 to represent my character.
Do you only have a single die that will represent your character?
That's what it sounds like, unless you can change as it goes through.
That's interesting because it sounds like a very indie game model. Yeah. That kind of intrigues me.
The comic series Die was modeled after because they were each represented by a die.
Maybe so.
Like a D12, D20.
It could be.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And then we got Moonlight Maps and Encounters. These are these nice little hardcover collections of, I want to say it was like 25 maps in each one. They're full color. They fold out. They're dry erase. And there's two different collections, and there's a ton of different terrain in them. They look really nice. And they're a good price.
Definitely, like, when you swing by, I think you can flip it over and you'll see all the maps on the back, and they look dope. Am I correct that one of our staffers, I believe, is picking one of those
up? Yep.
So hopefully we'll get to look at those soon, possibly even in a D&D game.
They also have encounter decks, so you can get... There's one that's combat, and there's one that's mystery.
Hmm.
So it gives you, like, a little encounter that you can use.
That's cool.
We also got Unmatched Tales to Amaze. This is the... Unmatched is that game system that uses these fancy miniatures and deck of cards.
But you play as characters, sometimes public domain, like Sherlock Holmes or Dracula, sometimes licensed, like Velociraptors and Deadpool.
They've got a ton of Marvel stuff.
Yeah.
They did Buffy as well.
But this adds a new cool thing.
This is a co-op game, and there's characters in here. I think Nikola Tesla is one of them.
Yeah.
A couple other characters, like Golden Age superhero or something.
Yep.
And you fight either Martians or something else, I can't remember. And the nice thing is you can bring in your unmatched character. So if you want to do Buffy versus Martians, you now have this.
Finally.
This is getting super good reviews.
Okay. Yeah,
very cool.
I've got it. I have not had a chance to open it yet, but I'm looking forward to playing it.
Nice.
We got Apiary, which I played at BGGCon. This is from the... it's a new designer, but it's from Stonemaier Games, the people who did Scythe and Wingspan and a few others. And
I guess they have a good reputation.
I played another one of their games, Libertalia, at BGG, and I've realized that these guys have a pretty good strike rate with me, at least.
Yeah.
This is more in the Scythe Wingspan. It's a little bit complicated as far as like having a learning curve.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, you are futuristic space bees building colonies.
Oh, I thought you were futuristic space beekeepers, perhaps.
Nope,
but you're the bees.
Space bees.
Woo.
So like, you move a queen bee ship around various places to explore. You use your little bee tokens to do various actions, like recruiting people into your hive.
That's wild.
It's very fun. I really, really enjoyed it. And it's beautiful. I would highly recommend it to people.
Yeah.
If you like Wingspan or Scythe, definitely would want to check out Apiary.
A very futuristic bee.
We got the G.I. Joe deck building expansion, Raise the Flag, with two G's.
Yes, because
it's the USS flag.
Yep.
And I believe this introduces sort of a campaign mode. I didn't get a chance to look through all the way through it, but I think it introduced a campaign
mode. I looked on the back and there's a 3D representation of the actual flag, so
that's pretty cool.
That alone is pretty cool.
It was the ultimate G.I. Joe vehicle and playset.
Yep.
And
it was an amazing thing.
Yeah.
We got a game called Perfect Match, as in cats.
Uh-huh. Yep.
And it is a cat matching game. There's five or six different colors of cats. And you
an all
like,
ages sort of thing?
It's definitely one you can play all ages.
Because sometimes I'll hear something like the premise, I'm like, oh, that sounds cute and adorable, and it's like, it's from the makers of Scythe, and incredibly complicated.
This is a quick play. I played this at BGG as well. If you are a cat lover or someone who's seen cats on the internet, you'll recognize. We flipped over one of the cards, and it was a cat licking his butthole.
Classic.
And there's a cat in a bag, there's a cat in a box.
Classic
there's
cat.
There's a lot of, there's, you will recognize various internet cats in cartoon form, and
nice.
You're just sort of doing a matching thing. You're trying to be the first to match. You want two of each type of cat on your,
okay.
on your thing.
That does sound fun.
You can spend things when you each turn. You like pull a thing that gives you fish that you can use to recruit cats.
This sounds like the kind of game that one could play with the family, or
yes.
maybe get a kid who might not be interested in the trade routes of Denmark game that
Correct.
You want to get them on board.
Correct.
And you're like, well, maybe if we start with the fun cat game.
Exactly right. We got a game called Boone Lake, which I'm not as familiar with.
Lake?
Boone Lake.
Does it spin on Groom Lake?
Nope.
Area 51 thing?
You build, raise cattle, expand, and explore in the fictional western U.S. region of Boone Lake.
Okay.
So this is just a resource management game.
Okay, well, that still sounds kind of cool.
Yeah. don't know much about this one, but it's one that I think is getting good reviews. It's got a 7.7 on BGG.
I was going to say, that's what I was just looking at.
That's quite solid.
We got a game that's another one I have not a chance to play. I kind of wish I'd known this. I would have tried to get it in at BGG. It's a game called Forever Home. That is a game about finding a forever home for your I believe your dogs, maybe cats and dogs.
Yeah, it's from the makers of Dog Park.
But it's from the makers of Dog Park, which I really liked. I played that this year and really enjoyed it. So that made me want to check this out. Yes, you help dogs in need find their new families by mastering puzzly training cards. So it's tile placement.
What kind of training cards?
Puzzly. So you use tile placement, set collection, and drafting. You are shelter workers, and you're trying to bring dogs into your shelter, match pups up with new families. It sounds super cool. I actually really, really love Dog Park, so this definitely has my attention.
Okay.
And I believe it has dog meeples.
Yay.
Puzzly.
We got Scholars of the South Tigris, which is another in the line of the Architects of the West Kingdoms. Never played any of these, but the art style looks cool, and I believe it's supposed to be a really good line of games.
They must be super popular, because the amount of expansions and kind of like base games that they've done for this thing is...
Yeah. And then we got Marvel Champions Deadpool and X-23, by which I mean we have one X-23, and Deadpool will be back in stock on Friday.
Yep.
But yeah.
This one flew off the shelf.
It did. People were super excited. All right, let's talk about comics for this week. Let's talk. It's Marvel is doing these flashback miniseries, and there are two of them this week. These are from creators who were much more like working in the 90s or the 80s,
yep.
Going back to their character that they were working. So it's like basically a
revisiting your best of area.
It's a time machine. You can go back and be like, oh, here's an original story that takes place between Daredevil 682 or whatever. So there's Daredevil Black Armor by D.G. Chichester, who was the writer who created the Black Armor Daredevil.
Yep.
And a new artist, Netho Diaz. It's not the original.
Am I correct, Randy, that Scott McDaniel was the artist on those early Daredevils?
So this takes us back to Matt getting his Black Armor. There's a flashback scene of what was going on. I forgot, like, there was the Devil and an undead Wolverine and Venom and Bald Elektra. There's all kinds of crazy stuff going on in the 90s, Daredevil. I read this run. I enjoyed this run.
Yeah.
Morbius, Silver Sable. But this story is about Matt. I guess during this point, he had created a second identity for himself as Jack Batlin. He was a con man who pretended he could see.
Oh, and, that's wild. That's not too crazy.
So, like, basically, he lived in Hell's Kitchen. He knew a bunch of people. There's this woman who's like a psychic who is, like, his new love interest. And basically, they all know he's, like a lovable con man. But he's, like, he wanted to create an identity for himself. There was not a lawyer. And
a little bit of his matches Malone.
Yep. He throws down with Sabretooth, who is involved in kidnapping people off the streets.
Cool, Sabretooth.
For another supervillain, who he's revealed at the end. There's a throwdown with Kingpin. It is a very much like a past Daredevil story.
Okay.
Right on. I always kind of like the Black Armor costume. Like, there's one of these things, like, my general maxim is, if you can't improve on a costume, don't make a new costume. But Daredevil has a great costume.
Yeah.
Right. We talked about this a little off mic yesterday, though, and what I was saying, in this era of, like, say, the cool Spider-Man video games, where there's lots of skins you can download, if you were to kind of think about it like that, not like where the comics they might try and have tricked you into thinking, oh yes, this is going to be the new costume forever, right. And then people get mad and it seems stupid in that context, but if you just think, this is a cool skin that he's going to have for a few adventures or whatever, well, that's kind of cool. Or he's going into like really dangerous territory, he needs the armor on.
I like that thought, and I wish that they did more of that when they were doing this kind of thing.
Right. It's one of those hindsight 2020 things, and said they had to be stupid.
It's we like the Arctic Attack versions of all the characters.
Everybody loves Arctic Attack, man.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, there's all these sub-genres of suits, so...
Speaking of classic costumes and making one better, the Black Costume Spider-Man is maybe one of the best examples of this. Like, it was so good that basically when they were going between black and red and blue, I was like, man, I don't know what I want, because I like them both.
Right. I think the thing with Spider-Man is you kind of have to go back to the red and blue, but the black is like one of the coolest costumes you can have.
It's such a good costume.
Yeah.
And so this story, which feels like a James Tynion title, Marvel Superheroes Secret Wars Battle World, #1.
The original miniseries was indeed called, although we often just say Secret Wars, Marvel Superheroes Secret Wars.
So this is a story that takes place, weirdly, between panels 4, 5, and 6 of issue number 12 of Secret Wars Spider-Man.
Oh, that was the final issue of it.
Yep. He says, I'm starved, I'm going to find me a snack. There's a question mark panel. And then he comes back and he's like, ah, here's the good old pantry. Alien food never looks so edible anyway. So basically, in between all this...
This is Spider-Man.
Spider-Man.
Okay.
He got teleported to it looks like the ice realm. There's like ice giants and wolves.
Okay.
And basically, Spidey wandered off during Secret Wars and had a whole little secret adventure.
I mean, that's not the craziest thing.
Nope. It's not. It is a little weird.
It is a little weird.
But so there's these people, there's these two entities talking about him, and they're clearly like, they're like, the Beyonder is a dope. They call him the Defective One.
Okay.
And then they're watching Spider-Man, and it's like that they are experimenting with Spider-Man in the way that the Beyonder, and Spidey thinks it's the Beyonder, but it's not. We don't know who it is. But he winds up in various, like, he winds up in an alien war, and eventually they bring in the Human Torch.
Wow, and all this time Spider-Man was trying to get a snack.
He just wanted a snack.
Yeah, and he accidentally got glitched into some other worlds.
Then they bring in a couple villains. It's very odd, but kind of fun.
Is it a one-shot?
No. It's a four-issue miniseries.
So he has 4 issues of adventures before he gets his snack?
Yes.
Oh my gosh, I'm going to be hungry for him by the end of this.
He's like griping about how hungry he is the whole time. We have a new book called The Holy Roller, which is a Rick Remender book, but it is co-written by Andy Samberg, who you might know from Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
Or the Lonely Island stuff.
And Joe Troman, who I think is also a Lonely Island person.
I thought one of the dudes is a guitarist for Fall Out Boy.
Okay, sure.
So that might be him.
So the guitarist for Fall Out Boy, the star of Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and Rick Remender wrote a comic.
Yep.
That's odd.
I'm going to go ahead and presume weed was involved.
Well, it is about someone using his bowling skills to fight Nazis.
Yep, it's the comic
is called old gym.
Holy Roller, and it's like, but you know, I can get behind Nazis taking a bowling ball to the face.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
What's weird is, like, it starts out, and it's like in this arcade, and it's like an 80s kids thing, where he's like being bullied by this rich kid.
Yep.
And then it jumps forward, and he suddenly is like this, this guy working on a Greenpeace boat.
Okay.
And then he goes home to see his dad, who was a bowler. And then he meets the bully again, who's now one of these...
Neo-Nazis?
He's a Nazi, but he's in that... or the guys who are marching with the tiki torches.
Oh.
Those Nazis.
Well, they're all losers, but what do you call those?
What's his name?
So here's the weird
the
thing.
The dude who was like their leader?
Yeah.
In this first issue, there is no one puts a costume on or anything like that.
Okay.
He just beats up a guy with a bowling ball.
All right.
It's very weird.
So one might say that this is the, aiming to be the vigilante Big Lebowski?
Yes, well, one might say that.
If I were to try and tag something that's too weird to probably be tagged?
Yeah, that sounds about right. Actually, if you told me those three were in a room getting high, and someone's like, they should put superheroes in Big Lebowski, I believe that is how it's going to happen. Anyway, if you want to read something super weird, if you like Remender stuff...
I mean, sure. Rick Remender is not an unpopular author.
No. He's not.
And I have been told that people like Andy Samberg and have listened to Fall Out Boy before.
I like Andy Samberg. I probably have heard some Fall Out Boy.
No. I bet you own a Fall Out Boy.
I own a Fall Out Boy?
Yes.
You think
on a little leash.
They're in my basement?
Your futuristic Mad Max Fall Out Boy.
Nobody owns music anymore, old man. This is Spotify. But yes, I do have a Fall Out Boy on my Spotify.
I knew it!
And then we've got... This is a book... This is a week for weird books, man.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So, Batman Off-World. This is Jason Aaron's first Batman.
Is it his first DC in a while? I know he has started at DC, I believe.
I think it is.
Did he start at DC?
He did a Vertigo project.
The Other Side with Cameron Stewart. That was his first book.
Oh, that's right.
And then he went and he's done a ton of stuff at Marvel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was he an editor...
He was just a writer.
Okay, and so now he's back, and there's this miniseries that has Batman and Aliens.
Yep. It's called Batman Offworld. It has art by Doug Mankey, who is spectacular.
Always good. He did a lot of Green Lantern stuff, right? Mm-hmm. So he knows how to draw aliens.
So Batman flies up in his bat spaceship and is taken captive in a prison and begins fighting aliens and runs into a Tamaranian cyborg who basically sort of becomes his friend. And the reason Batman is on this prison is very, like, Dave said it will work really well in Brave and the Bold, and I think that's right.
Right. I believe he gets his, doesn't he, like, run into an alien for the first time?
Yes, and he's gets like, I need to learn how to fight aliens, which means I need to go to the space prison.
Played straight, it's a little crazy.
Yeah.
If it was told with the, or Silver Age Batman Brave and the Bold.
This is kind of fun. I actually thought this was kind of fun. It is weird. It is a weird premise, but it's got really good art. And it's a fun idea that, I will say this, I've never seen Batman done in this way before.
It's true.
It's new.
Do we want to hit the other...
Let's talk about Somna.
All right.
Okay. Which is another number one from this week. Which is from Distillery. Sorry, Distillery. They don't have... There's no vowels in their name.
It's spelled like your goofy Roosevelt shirt, right?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
That's why everybody's doing it these days.
It's all their fault.
So this is their second book.
Yes, after second Jock's... book after Gone.
Yeah.
This is a this is by Becky Cloonan and Tula Lote.
Yep.
And I forget, Becky Cloonan wrote some really good, like, haunted house stories.
Yeah.
There's a graphic novel she has. And I always think of her more of an artist. But did she do any of the art on this? I feel like she did. There's some sequences I think
she did.
She does some of the sequences. Oh, yeah. So this is about a woman who is married to a witch burner.
During the Salem witch trial era.
An actual witch burner.
He goes out and he burns witches.
Yes. Okay?
And he is like this harsh guy, and she loves him, but he is very much the, I am a noble man, and I cannot even touch my wife.
Yeah.
And she is like having naughty thoughts, which are illustrated by Tula Lote's sort of painted style art, which seems to be some sort of dark, devilish figure is trying to seduce her.
Yeah, it's a simple premise, but it's executed really, really well.
It's done really well.
Both of their artwork is phenomenal. I mean, Tula Lote's...
This is in that slightly taller style. It looks more like a magazine.
Yeah.
It's my favorite thing Distillery's done so far, actually. I was not expecting much out of this, but it is very, very beautiful and is what we would call an erotic thriller.
Yes.
And this is a Salem Witch era erotic thriller?
Yes.
Okay, that sounds like a good hook. I'm interested.
It's actually pretty good.
And it is.
Like I said, the art throughout is spectacular. Becky Cloonan and Tula Lote are both super talented.
Yep. I vote for more erotic thrillers.
All right. Well, let's talk about the other erotic thriller this week, and that's Carnage. I assume. I haven't read it, but I assume it's an erotic thriller.
So, yeah, Carnage number one, a new series written by Torin Grunbeck, which was Jason Aaron's writing partner for a lot of, like, the Thor stuff.
I did not know that.
Yeah, he's gone on
to
do a few other things. This is basically... Cletus Cassidy has been dead. A long time.
Apparently so.
Lately,
we've forgotten this.
Lately, it's just been the Carnage symbiote running around.
So Cletus got torn in half by Sentry in New Avengers number one.
I feel like that's where
that's it?
I feel like that's where he died.
Well, we don't know that for sure.
We don't know that 100%. That's speculation.
Because that was like 15...
Your Honor,
that was like 15...
Speculation.
That was like 15 years ago, right?
It was a long time ago.
That was Bendis.
Yep. And, but be that as it may, and meanwhile, Carnage, the symbiote thing... has been trying to become a god, I believe.
Yeah, he tried to become a god, and then Null didn't really like that, and but he's still tough. But he kind of, the symbiote realizes that he needs Cletus back.
Mm-hmm.
So this is like
for strategic reasons, or is this like that Eddie Brock symbiote thing where he's like, I need my bro,
I think it's a little bit of the latter part of that. And he rebirths Cletus.
Okay.
Into Cletus, the current...
For the record, Cletus did come back and then die again.
Oh, did he?
Okay.
Okay.
What did he die of?
I don't know when.
The second time.
He came back, he was revealed...
Don't tease us, Randy.
He was revealed in some story called Family Feud that both of his legs have been severed, his body was preserved by the symbiote, and he was repaired by somebody's prosthetics, and then he became Carnage again.
He got Darth Mauled?
Yes, he did.
Interesting.
Actually, that's more like he got Flash Thompson.
Then there was Carnage USA, Superior Carnage, where he was lobotomized...
So what you're saying is Cletus has had a lot has happened to him.
He gets killed. He gets killed a lot.
If Spider-Man's probably been dead five times.
And people talk about Jean Grey, but it is clear to me from reading this Wikipedia article that Cletus Cassidy has been killed and reborn numerous times.
Cletus is the Jean Grey of symbiotes.
He's the Jean Grey of symbiotes.
Okay, well, this is the first time I've ever seen a symbiote rebirth
despite this goofiness,
a host.
This is him using that is high level power to. You mean he like recreates him just from nothingness?
Yes, he kills somebody and then using the genetic material that he's able to get from that body,
they get Cletus'd up
and the sensory memory from the symbiote, he recreates Cletus as whole.
Listen, that's not that. That's kind of cool. I like that.
It's a cool idea, and it's also cool because this has a little bit of a Hannibal type feel. Because this is a serial killer that hasn't been around for a while, kind of readapting to his surroundings and to the technology of the world. And
yeah, you were mentioning that there's a.
Sorry, one of our trailers started early.
Trailer pipe down. Nobody asked you for that.
But it's a...
You were mentioning that hook, and I thought that sounded kind of cool, the...
Serial killer fish out of water.
Serial killer fish out of water, because, like, Cletus Cassidy, like, if you're going to do something from his perspective, it's a little weird, because he's a creepy killer, man.
It's true.
But throwing these kind of wrinkles in there, as well as the strange way he was resurrected, that sounds
kind of
cool.
But he definitely... Cletus has a plan, and, it's a good first issue. Beautifully drawn by,
Is this an ongoing series, by the way?
I think it's just a mini-series, if I had to guess. But art by Pere Perez, just makes it very, very pretty. And makes the violence very pretty. I thought it was a good first issue.
All right.
Okay.
What else we got?
All right. So we also have Justice League versus Godzilla versus Kong number 2.
Yep.
Which features the Bat family taking on a giant bat, and Superman finding out that Godzilla is not someone you talk to.
It's true.
I thought that was a cool idea, though, that Superman would indeed assume there's the possibility that this is a sentient creature, and he tries to talk to him, and he gets into a fight, and but they are dispatching multiple Justice League members.
They call in the whole Justice League.
Yep, and there are multiple monsters too. There's also there's a few others in there. Are these, I believe, other ones that have shown up in the movies?
Yes.
Yeah,
I saw the word spider dudes from the Skull Island.
Yep.
And do we think? I think. Maybe that Toy Man has a hold of Dr. Destiny's gem, and he is somehow unleashing them.
Yes.
It's weird. It's a weird
and
premise.
Controlling, yeah.
Like I say, it's a week for weird stuff.
It is.
It's not that weird.
there's Central City, Themyscira, and Gotham are all being menaced by creatures, too. You know who's not turned up yet? Kong.
That's true.
It's true.
Kong's going to come raging in issue 3, I suspect.
Yes.
Maybe to help Superman.
Wonder if he will...
that'd be handy.
Wonder if he will be in Gorilla City.
That'd be kind of cool. Superman, I'm going to say, is in a bit of a rough spot at times in this one.
I did appreciate him not, like, outright just punching Godzilla to start with, though. Yep. That felt very like Superman.
Very Superman. Yeah. Issue 2 of Universal Monsters Dracula by James Tynion and Martin Simmons. Very moody and effective. If you like the first issue, you'll like the second one.
I love Simmons' artwork.
Yeah, it's really good.
It works so well for Dracula.
And I do want to mention the third issue of Avengers Inc., which sees Janet and Victor Shade go to Asgard to find out who killed the Executioner in Valhalla, which is really fun. I'm really liking this Avengers Inc. book.
I need to read that. I really like the first two issues, and so I will probably be on board this one. That's Al Ewing, right?
That's Al Ewing. Yeah,
he's been on my hot list lately because I really like Immortal Thor too.
He actually ties a little bit into Immortal Thor in this.
Yeah. I guess it's an Oscar.
I mean, he's writing it, so he knows.
We should mention there was the sixth issue, I believe, concluding the first arc of Void Rivals.
Yep.
the sort of sister book to the new Transformers G.I. Joe, the Energon universe.
Yep. And they're going to take a break until March.
Okay.
They're taking a break between story arcs.
Okay. And that's kind of for, I would imagine, for the full launches of the new books. Or, like, kind of to give them room to breathe, probably.
Also, it does have a four-page backup showing the first four pages of Cobra Commander.
Yep.
Which is good.
It looks really good.
See Cobra Commander doing some evil things.
He's very evil.
Yeah.
Green Lantern War Journal number 3. Still enjoying this book quite a bit. It's the Jon Stewart Green Lantern book. The penultimate Nightwing as a pirate story this week. And also Titans number 5, the final issue of Titans before Beast World, which also resolves the Flash seemingly getting killed.
Yep.
And I like the way they did that. It was very, very cool detective-y stuff by Nightwing.
Yep.
It was good. And then Sensational She-Hulk number 2, which sees Hulk guest star. And if you've been liking She-Hulk, it's more She-Hulk. And I think that's it for me. You guys have anything else on your stack of reading list?
Nope.
All right. Let's take a break. We're going to come back and talk about some trailers and some news. All right, so we got a bit of news and a couple trailers to talk about. Let's talk about the big casting news that just hit. I don't know if it's been officially 100% announced, but it sounds like...
Oh.
I think it is.
Sounds like Nicholas Holt,
yep.
a.k.a. The Beast,
a.k.a.
Renfield,
and
a.k.a.
the guy from
Warboy.
Fury Road Warboy, yeah.
Yep.
Is going to play Lex Luthor in the Superman Legacy.
Yeah.
I don't know how I feel about this.
Why?
I like Nicholas Holt. I don't see him as Luthor.
I think he's a pretty good get.
Well, it was rumored that at first he was going to play Clark, and I think a lot of people would...
He would not have been a good Superman.
No, I don't think so.
What age is Holt? 30-something?
30-something?
Yeah.
He's a baby face. He looks young.
Yep. I believe...
You shave his head, you make him look like Luthor.
He can Warboy again.
That's right.
I feel like he's played kind of like...
He's probably not going to be wearing like a leather jumpsuit like he did in Everybody Does in Mad Max.
Has he ever played a villain?
I don't know.
I think he did in something.
Anyway, I like Nicholas Holt. He doesn't scream Luthor to me. I mean, for one thing, when they've got, like, Gene Hackman really kind of owned that version of Luthor.
Yep.
Although that's a very different version of Luthor.
Yep.
And then, like, was it Michael Rosenbaum in Smallville was a really good Luthor. Mm-hmm. Weirdly, Kevin Spacey was a very good Luthor. It's almost like being a creep made you a good creep. This just doesn't feel like, I'm not like, you know, if they had told me like, what do you call it? Who's Walter White?
Right. That was like a popular fan cast.
Giancarlo Esposito, one of those guys. Holt doesn't have that sinister vibe that I want.
Yeah.
He was pretty mean in The Menu.
Yeah, but he was kind of jerky mean. He wasn't.
Yeah.
He wasn't like super smart mean. I don't know. He's a good actor. He could probably pull it off.
Yeah,
it's just.
He doesn't instantly register.
Everything I'm hearing about James Gunn's DCU makes me a little more nervous.
One thing we don't know, for instance, is what their Luthor is going to be like.
Right.
Well, you know, for years we've had the kind of untouchable businessman. That's been some version of him since the 80s. And then they kind of did the, what's it, Michael Cera or fake Michael Cera? Whichever.
Yes.
It's not Michael Cera. It's Jesse Eisenberg.
It's played him as more or less like Zuckerberg, right?
Yes.
He was like eviler Zuckerberg. Less evil Zuckerberg. I don't know.
Which I thought Eisenberg's take was good.
So
I mean, it was, but I just wanted to... I want a Luthor that I think is cool and not that I want to punch.
So here's the weird thing. Superman Legacy announced another villain. I don't know if you know this.
I believe I've heard speculation that Luthor, will almost be like maybe more of a side character... I bet, like, kind of secretly running some 3D chess.
Who's the other villain?
The villain is?
No.
It's the engineer from The Authority.
I know that, I believe...
Maria Gabriela de Faria.
That's going to be the villain? Engineer.
That's the villain.
I have heard, or, like, the vibe I have gotten is that, yes, I knew a little bit about this, is that, what do you call it, the...
Remember they're doing The Authority movie.
No, I know.
Is that they are essentially setting up what, without doing the analog, the What's So Funny About Truth, Justice, and the American Way story,
yeah.
as maybe their first major arc.
Hmm. That is a weird thing to start
So they will
with.
Ultimately have... But, it, like, I don't know if, like, that will be the... It's not going to be the first Superman movie, but I guess it'll be the arc of some of these things.
Interesting.
Where,
so that means, like, in
What is that? Manchester Black, and what do they call them in the...
Oh.
Like, it's not the Authority, they're the dudes.
I forget exactly what their title was, but I remember what you're talking about.
Yeah, for people who don't know, let's see. Wait, the engineer was in the Authority?
She was in the Authority.
The Authority was a popular 90s kind of subversive superhero comic by Warren Ellis that imagined superheroes who would, like, kind of willingly change the shape of the world in a way that they don't usually even kind of want to show in Marvel and DC, where it's like, oh, this country has become a rogue nation and has a nuke, well, we're going to go topple their government. Well, you know, like, Superman wouldn't do that, but in The Authority...
You have people like Midnighter.
Midnighter and Apollo would. And so they later on in the comics created an analog to them so that Superman could beat them, basically.
Right.
And they did a storyline that showed that, like, for all their kind of devious tactics and, you know, kind of the Warren Ellis style that they were known for, that Superman, wholesome as he is, could match them and beat them. And the story is a pretty well-known story from... What, early
2000s? Yeah.
I'm
and so it seems like they're doing a version of that, which is weird to me, but I'll say this, it has the benefit of not having been done in live action.
Yeah, for sure. That's
I'm a little weirded out in the first Superman movie we're going to get, like, the bleed.
This is what I'm weirded out, too. It seems like... I think there's a virtue to not doing the origin again.
Yeah.
But I don't know that jumping right into the, like, what would be, like, 30 years of Superman stories and here's a new Superman story is the right way to go either. I don't know. My faith in James Gunn is pretty strong, but I'm a little weirded out by the news that's coming out of what they're doing for DC.
I mean, it sort of makes sense to me because, like, you know, the other options would be, like, hey, it's a new take on Parasite or just something like that. This is something that we, you know, that story that we were talking about, the what's so funny about truth, justice, and the American way, is like one of those key Superman stories of the modern era. It's always going to come up if you're talking about some of the best Superman stories
Gunn
of the last 20 years.
I saw Gunn posting, like, a big, like, one of his big boards with all things. And I saw that Superman for All Seasons was on there as
so
well.
It's like a Jeff Johns thing. Is like, you know, Jeff Johns likes those murder board things.
He does like the big board.
James Gunn, a guy who does this?
Probably so. He does seem to be a big... I mean, he's got to be the big planner, so it makes sense that he might have a murder board.
I mean, I like For All Seasons. I mean,
I'm not the biggest fan of All Seasons, but I don't know what he's going to take from it. Like, maybe he's going to take stuff that I liked. I did like parts of it for sure.
Yeah, we'll see.
But yeah, it's a little bit weird.
Anyway, another big bit of news which just dropped: Dave Filoni has been promoted to Chief Creative Officer at Lucasfilm.
I didn't know about that.
So he is going to
taking over from
planning the future of Star Wars, working alongside Kathleen Kennedy.
Okay,
he is going to be. Planning the future of Star Wars films and shows, which is, I thought he already was.
Well, I think he's one of those that I think gets a lot of credit for doing stuff, but I think people behind the, there are other people behind the scenes. Yeah. It's interesting that he's going to take over. I think that's a good plan.
Yeah.
I think Filoni...
he's probably been the most corrective influence to Star Wars of the last 20 years. Alongside, I have to give credit to Gennady Tartakovsky, for really, because this is, we're like, what, the 20th anniversary, I believe, of the Clone Wars shorts that he did, and I saw that pop up in my Facebook memories, or like it, or not in my Facebook memories, but an article on it, and I'm like, that show reminded me that Star Wars could be redeemed, essentially, at a time when I don't know that I thought it could.
It's a little surprising to me, after sort of the lukewarm reception that a lot of people gave Ahsoka.
Yeah.
But
broadly, he has been a pretty popular...
I mean...
He's done so much
Star Wars
stuff.
Animation, like, he resurrected a lot of it, I mean...
Right, and Mandalorian was something of a success.
Filoni is definitely can be the Kevin Feige for Star Wars.
Yeah, he also has that gene of, like, splicing together stories, bringing back the good stuff while trying to make some of the odd stuff, or...
He's able to redeem the crap stuff.
Yeah.
Nobody's been able to make Jar Jar work for me, but the closest anyone's come was David Filoni.
Yeah. And somebody, was it Mando himself, I believe, used the term wizard.
He did.
Which we talked about that, and we're like, that is quite the fact that you could use that, and even if you're being a little ironic, make it pretty cool, was quite the feat.
Tim Miller, who did Deadpool as well as Terminator Dark Fate, which is an underrated movie, I think.
I think so, too.
He is developing Alien Legion, which is a 80s...
Marvel property.
It was created by Carl Potts.
Mm-hmm.
And is basically described as the French Foreign Legion in space.
I read this comic because my brother had it.
I've read bits and pieces of it. It's really cool.
I don't think I've heard of this one.
Alien Legion was put out through their Epic line, so it would have had the mature, something like a mature reader's label. I think they still used fake swear words in it. They like the same they did it kind of stuff they did in Legion of Superheroes, say.
Right.
But content wise, it was sort of more adult situations. And like, I remember some dude in like the first issue gets in like a brawl in a bar or something like that. And again, I think kind of Star Trek type aliens. But one of the main dudes is like a this cool looking snake alien. He's got like his lower torso is like a big snake.
Okay.
You know, 20 feet long or whatever. And they had like really cool armor that looked like Mass Effect before Mass Effect was around.
Yep.
And
so far you have my attention.
And it had like this kind of edgier military adventure vibe. Anyway, this guy gets in a barroom fight, I remember, and like just like dies of like he gets like a hemorrhage or something and just dies. And I was like, oh, this is not going to be like quite G.I. Joe. This is going to have a little bit more edge to it. And they I remember them going up against like space pirates, but these space pirates had more of a like nasty marauder thing. You know, they were like, I was used to Marvel Comics space pirates, but these were guys who would, like, decimate, you know, worlds and things like
that.
These
were mean space pirates.
Mean space pirates.
Man, they've been trying to do this for 20 years.
Really?
Yeah, it was set up at Miramax and Dimension Films. Bruckheimer was involved with it. David Benioff wrote a script.
Oh, wow.
Like, it's been around for a while.
It kind of makes sense that this is a better era for it, because I think... I think you almost needed sort of like a popular game like Mass Effect that was kind of realistic sci-fi, but still adventuresome sci-fi. Because, like, if there's a tone that it will be shooting for, I think that's it.
Yeah.
It's not quite as... It's more focused. It is military action.
I will say the character designs are really cool looking.
Mm-hmm.
I do like the snake
guy.
I can't
remember who the artist was.
Early on, later it was Wilche Portacio, but that was one of his first books. But early on, I don't remember.
Huh, interesting.
It's Alan... No.
Alan Zlenitz? No. Maybe? I don't remember.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Carl Potts and Alan Zlenitz, okay. Frank Sirico, and Terry Austin.
And what about useful information my brain pushed out to remember Alan Zlenitz?
I was going to say, that's impressive.
I've read one trade of this that Dark Horse did 20 years ago.
And weirdly, I think when Dark Horse did it, I think they didn't have access to the early issues. I think they had to start with some of the later ones.
Yeah, I think that's right.
So you may not have read what I kind of consider the early best stuff of it.
I do remember thinking it wasn't great.
Yeah.
So that probably makes sense.
Now, I also think that the early stuff, like, probably doesn't hold up great because there has been, you know, 30, 40 years or whatever it is between now and then.
Right.
But I think that the roots that are there for probably a pretty good movie.
Now, is Tim Miller the person to do it?
I kind of think maybe so.
Who's Tim? Oh, the Deadpool.
Deadpool. He's kind of a frenetic. Didn't he start on, like, John Wick? Like, wasn't he like, a second unit director?
And what was the other thing he's made?
Deadpool?
Terminator Dark Fate.
Dark Fate is really good.
That's a different vibe from Deadpool.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's still got some of the action set pieces that Deadpool did.
Right. And there was, like, you know, even a Terminator movie usually has some humor in it.
Yep.
So it's not just all dour all the time.
Did the comic have some humor? Or was it kind of,
I don't remember much.
Gallows humor kind of thing?
I think it's gallows humor.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I just remembered that the hard ass of the team was Jugger Grimrod,
yes,
if I'm not mistaken.
That is correct.
He had a little... what do you call those wires you use to
garrot?
To choke people out? Yeah, he had a garrot that came out from his like little wrist, a little wrist bracelet thing, and he was the silent killer of the group. In a way, he was almost like, you know, the Snake Eyes or the Wolverine, but like scary, like
okay,
a little bit of maybe Joe Pesci in there, where you might be like, oh, I don't know, and I don't like this guy, but he's a good killer.
Okay, this sounds interesting. I'm curious.
Yeah.
All right, Dave, you posted a thing about this. Remember, we talked about this a while back. The D&D 24-hour network,
yes,
that runs on Freevee and Plex,
yep,
has officially launched.
Yes, does anybody have access to this stuff?
Freevee, we all do. Amazon Prime has Freevee.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's on Amazon Prime.
So this is...
So are they like playing like nonstop games?
I don't know what they're doing, but it says there are three shows. Faster, Purple Worm, Kill, which... This is weird. I didn't realize Beatles and Grimm, which is the people who do, like, really fancy editions
of
all the
Navy
stuff.
Yeah, all the books.
That is owned by Matthew Lillard.
Right, who's okay, a big nerd.
Yeah, I knew
nerd.
He was a big nerd.
So this
he was
is
a big
thing
D&D
that he
thing.
Hosts. Celebrity players pit first-level D&D characters against the game's mightiest monsters. That's pretty fun.
So it's like a Coliseum of...
Did they say first-level characters?
They're going to die.
Yeah, first level characters. They're going to die.
There must be some other additional thing, or they would just all die. Unless you're betting on what the thing, how it kills them, like how Tiamat kills them.
I'm curious to watch this, though. There's two episodes out on, looks like, so far.
Yeah.
I
knew that
curious.
None of us had seen it, but I figured, like, this might put it on our radar and other people's radar.
Wasn't there supposed
if
to
you've
like
seen it, write to us and tell us.
You know, here's the thing. I've yet to find a D&D live play that works for me. It's just not a format that works for me.
Yeah.
But I'm curious about this.
I think part of it is, like...
Obviously it exists because...
The D&D that I like to play... And I'm a much more casual,
yeah,
occasional player. Is a little bit more straightforward. I don't want like quite like Lord of the Rings serious. I like some humor in my D&D and stuff like that. But
well,
I don't like the. I also
wacky.
I'm not the murder hobo person, and I'm not the wacky one,
yeah,
either. And so, a lot of they don't usually fit for me either. But
well, Dave, perhaps what you might like is their full length D&D campaign on TV called Encounter Party, 22 1-hour long episodes, 7 professional actors. Guide their characters from the high seas to the dangerous streets of Baldur's Gate and into the very jaws of fate. So this was an audio podcast,
okay,
that they have converted after 3 years to a video podcast with terrain and a fancy table and all this stuff,
okay,
and then playing a 22-episode campaign.
Does it say what celebrities are... I'm just curious.
I'm
like the level
the table,
of...
I don't recognize any of these people.
Okay.
There's a trailer.
Like Deborah Ann Woll?
Oh, wait, here we go. Cast. Let's see. Okay, I've heard of none of these people. Okay. So the cast is Brian David Judkins, Ned Donovan, Landry Fleming, David Lee Huen, Sarah Babe, Carrie Payton, and Andrew Krug.
Not to be mean to any of those people, but you just...
Landry Fleming?
You made up all those names right now, right?
I didn't. These are all real people, but I've never heard of any of them.
Actually, out of curiosity, do they describe them as celebrities?
They describe them as professional actors.
Okay, well, there you go. They didn't say they were celebrities. No. So we shouldn't hold that against them that they didn't get Vin Diesel. That said, the main thing that interested me about that was the hour episode thing. Yep. One thing that I couldn't ever quite get into was the sheer length of time required for a Critical Role. Like, yep. You would have to listen for like 3 or 4 hours or whatever it is. And yet I understand why, because there's a lot of kind of looking up of rules and what does your character do, and you know, well, let's all introduce ourselves and all that kind of stuff to D&D, and it can be a little draggy. And so if they've edited that down to 1 hour episodes, that kind of interests me. That means they've tightened it up.
The other show is called Heroes Feast, and it is a pair of chefs along with Matthew Lillard bringing the D&D cookbook to they pick a recipe from the book and they cook it.
See, I think that sounds awesome.
There are also dice rolls for ingredients.
Okay, that show I'll watch because that's my that's cooking fun. Show.
Does, I was like, yeah, Heroes Feast is the name of the book, and so they made a show about the book.
It's a good idea. Yeah. It's a little strange, but
the weirdest thing is that it's happening in such an obscure place that I don't know quite how you grow that if a lot of people are going to just have it on their radar. But D&D is like a niche thing, and they may be a little bit we start out small, we slow burn it, people see that it's hopefully good material and blah, blah,
I don't
blah,
know
blah.
If it's a niche thing anymore. I know, I think I that's become either. Kind of part of the culture and mainstream. I saw this weekend that Chris Pine...
Take the movie sales do not bear that
well,
out.
Well, no, and this is kind of disproving that, I guess. Over the weekend, somebody interviewed Chris Pine. He said the second one's happening.
I'm sure he did. I looked at this interview. He did not say the second one is happening. He said something like, I still have hope that it could happen. Mm-hmm. It was very much
But I mean...
It was the kind of thing you say when you don't know, even if it's unlikely... And the article pointed out that the numbers it pulled in were like 200-something million, which is doesn't make, you know, like, with its budget and promotion, doesn't make much back. Yeah. The article straight said, like, that this is not usually what gets sequels greenlit. But it does have a high, it is well-liked.
Yeah.
And so that's what may make it happen.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, that article, the gist of it was not that this it was mainstream.
It's more mainstream than it used to be, but it is definitely not mainstream.
Yeah, it hit, I think, a little bit better than, say, the Serenity movie did, which nobody turned up for, apparently.
I mean, I know because budgets are high, but $200 million is not nothing.
Apparently it is.
In this day and age, yes.
Because the Marvels made like $150 million its first weekend, and it's called the biggest bomb Marvel's ever had.
Yeah, and so. Killers of the Flower Moon made $150 million, and it's touted as an amazing feat.
Yeah, although, again, it didn't make its money back, so...
Apple doesn't care.
Yeah, that's probably right.
Apple doesn't make money off of movies.
All right, we got 3 trailers. One of them was good. and I believe all of us in this room liked one of them. So let's start with role play. The one that Nick chose is one to defend.
I mean, okay. I like Kaylee Cuoco and
David Oyelowo.
I'm just going to call him Bass Reeves because that's who he is right now.
What is this on?
This is on Prime.
Yeah, it's a Prime, but it's a movie. It's not a show.
Right.
And it has kind of vibes of Mr. and Mrs. Smith. It's
True Lies.
Basically, gender flips it has Kaylee Cuoco as the assassin who's living a normal life with her husband.
Her husband has no idea that she's an international assassin.
And then he finds out, and zaniness ensues.
It also looks like that stupid Mark Wahlberg thing we talked about a couple weeks ago.
It looks so much better than that.
Better than that, which is not a high bar to clear.
No.
I'll say this, like, I don't think it had a bad trailer or anything. I just don't really have any interest in what looks like a concept I've seen before and which was still best done in True Lies in 1994.
Mm-hmm. Right. And there will definitely be diminishing returns. I didn't think it looked amazing, but I thought it looked competent and had some fun action
sequences. So you're excited for the diminishing returns?
Well, I mean... Now, you I don't could say a lot of things about movies of just doing the same story again and again.
Yeah.
I mean...
Well, like, here's the thing is, like, it could be good. I you know, like, there's no reason, like, you know, I've seen, you know, Die Hard knockoffs, but, I don't know, executive decision is Die Hard on a plane, and it's still a really good movie.
Right.
And it's different enough. Maybe this will ultimately be different enough.
I was trying to... I didn't look to see who was directing it.
At a glance...
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to state, you know, anything that it's going to be the best movie.
Do you like the leads, though, Nick?
I do. I think they usually put in really good performance. I think Kaley Cuoco has...
I don't doubt that they will
who basically took
that.
Her career as bit from Big Bang and did some very interesting things.
She's a great Harley Quinn.
She's a great Harley Quinn. I liked The Flight Attendant. The weird podcast show
she made, yep.
Was weird, but I enjoyed
she
it.
She is definitely liking weird. She definitely does do weird stuff.
Yeah, her taste definitely...
Presumably, having been on Big Bang Theory for, 9 years, whatever it was.
God, I thought it was longer than
she
that.
Must have made a ton on that.
Yeah, and she can just do passion
now
projects.
Now she can do her passion projects, yeah.
We got the trailer for What If Season 2, which I'm super looking forward to.
Did you like the first season?
Quite a bit, actually.
Yeah.
I think there's a couple misses in there. I think the Doctor Strange episode was weak, and I thought the Bro Thor was awful.
What was the Bro Thor?
It was literally just Bro Thor.
I mean, like,
doing parties around the world.
Was there what was the premise of the episode?
I can't remember what the what if was, to be honest.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the problem. Is sometimes the what if is like
a little nebulous.
The problem is what if is not just Elseworlds. What if should be here is a fork in the road. And unfortunately, Marvel's What If animation is very much Elseworlds. It's like,
right,
here's a fun alternate take.
Well, for instance, we saw in this one what looks like an adaptation of Neil Gaiman's 1602
yep.
Marvel graphic novel, which does, like, just literally reconceive the Marvel Universe in 1602. And it's, you know, there's a lot of cool ideas, like, oh, and the Spanish Inquisition, instead of going after heretics, is going after mutants.
Yep.
And, like, there's lots of neat ideas in it. But it is not a traditional what-if branching point thing. So, but I'm sure, Randy, they had stuff like that in mind. Like, we want to adapt this, we want to adapt that, and we don't want to be limited.
The right. First season adapted Marvel Zombies in probably the best way possible.
It's one of my favorite, maybe my favorite episode.
Yeah, it is definitely the standout. I think it's supposed to even get its own, like, series
and
eventually.
When the Watcher introduces him, does he not then pose a question, or does he do it sometimes?
I think he does.
Yeah.
Okay.
I love.
So, what is the premise of the Marvel Zombies one?
There were zombies. I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I think it's a little bit of a, you know. I just remember really enjoying the episodes.
Most of the shows worked really well for
okay.
me.
Like, the first one was what if Haley Atwell, Peggy Carter became.
Right,
the Super Soldier Serum.
And they are doing a sequel to that one this time.
Yep.
Because they actually reveal at the end of that episode that Steve Rogers is still alive and the Hydra Stomper.
Yep.
So, this is going to be a modern day. Captain Carter, Hydra Stomper episode. Looking forward to that. There's clearly some kind of, like, 60s, 70s Avengers, which has Lawrence Fishburne voicing Giant Man.
Yep.
The original voice of T'Chaka playing a younger Black Panther. Maybe up against...
it's Michael Douglas and Hank Pym.
Michael Douglas and Hank Pym. There is a young Mohawk woman who is an original MCU character who seems to be a...
you mean Mohawk, like
Indian,
the native tribe?
Yes,
yeah,
native tribe. Yes.
Hmm.
Who's basically being trained by Doctor Strange? Gamora and Tony Stark have an episode that ties into the previous episodes that was cut in the first season.
Oh, okay. Looked like there was a Death Race kind of
there
vibe.
Like some kind
one.
Of Death Race 2000 vibe. we don't know too much. I was looking to see if they had like a listing of the episodes, and they don't, which I'm kind of glad.
Yeah, I don't want to know everything going in.
But the other cool thing is that starting on December 22nd, and then every day, they're going to release another episode.
That's
it
great.
It also looks like there's a Die Hard riff with Happy Hogan playing the Die Hard character.
And Darcy.
Yep.
Showing
yep.
up. And yep. I love that they're able to...
Is Darcy the... who's the cop in Die Hard?
Oh, is she going to play...
What's his character's name?
The Al.
Al.
Yeah, Darcy is Al.
I think that would be kind of fun.
Mm-hmm.
I love that they're able to get the same actors mm-hmm. to come in and do some voice work for a day.
And when they don't, they got Lake Bell to do Black Widow. She's great as Black Widow.
She's great. Well, Lake Bell's just great.
Yeah.
Lake Bell.
She's done a ton of voice acting.
Yeah, okay. She does tons.
That's very cool.
She actually even showed up in Black Panther, the second one.
Yeah, the Death Race 2000 seems to be a... on Sakaar.
Oh,
it does have Grandmaster as well.
It does have Goldblum showing
and
back
up. So it seems
up.
Like a riff on that. And there's also Shang-Chi.
Yeah, that was. I saw that. They brought back the dragon and stuff. Yep. But
I don't have an interest in What If, so this is just not on my radar.
Yeah.
My favorite part of the trailer, though, was indeed seeing Jeff Goldblum's character. What is his character? Grandmaster. Being the narcissist that he is. And I was like, that's fun stuff.
I like the animation style. I saw some people balking at it a little bit.
I like the animation style, too. I know some people don't like it. I'm on board.
I mean, the animation style is basically CG with cell shading over it, same as Dragon Prince.
Yeah.
Just maybe a little more realistic than Dragon Prince.
Yeah.
It looks pretty good to me. It's also not my thing, but, like, clearly well done. Like, whenever I see glimpses of it, I'm like, oh, these look like good action sequences and pretty emotive characters and stuff, so.
That was the trailer I've chosen to defend.
Yeah.
Dave has chosen to defend the Madam Web trailer, which Nick and I did not like.
Sure. Well, I think part of it is that we're bringing all our comic baggage to it and like, oh, what? They made this character into this? But the truth is these are all Z-list characters. Madam Web is the best-known one, and she's just was a supporting character for the most part at best in Spider-Man comics. And they rebuilt it into an original project and kind of, you know, used some of the ideas for springboards. But what I think works about this is that the trailer just as a standalone sort of stealth superhero movie, but in the guise of kind of a
sci-fi horror almost.
Yeah, almost sci-fi horror thing is, I think it works as a trailer. I think general audiences might think that looks cool, and if anything, will be weirded out that there are some costumes by the end of it.
Yeah.
So that part was, but you know, that was clearly the intent.
I got some serious Morbius vibes from it. That's what I got.
You're going to say that about all of them, though, right?
I mean, but it does. It feels like
but
Morbius.
But Randy didn't watch Morbius. I watched Morbius.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think so. Like, you know, there's... Unless you're just like, oh, this just looks like bad quality. But
I do think it looks like bad quality.
I think all of these movies will have something good in them.
This one had an interesting thing with a lot of women bonding who are all part of... with the central character who's Madam Web, in the comic she has psychic... she's precognitive or whatever. She can see the future.
Yeah.
And the one thing I knew her from was, like, an amazing two-part Spider-Man story with the Juggernaut in it back in the day. But even then, she was just... she was the MacGuffin in it. She wasn't really a character.
Mm-hmm.
In this, though, what's her name from Fifty Shades of Grey?
Dakota Johnson.
Dakota Johnson.
Always like her.
Plays her... Madame Web in the comics, at least originally, was this old woman.
and, woman in a chair.
Quite prettier now, but they have... done versions of Madame Web in the comic that have also been youthful and pretty.
Well, that's exactly. Julia Carpenter, who was the Spider-Woman from Secret Wars,
who
has a great costume.
Yep.
Right. She became Madame Web, and she's wearing, like, the red... So they clearly are taking that visual and mapping it onto the original, because Julia Carpenter is in this movie as well.
Yes. Right. And so is
Right.
Rania,
the more you know about the comics, the more complicated it'll seem. But if you don't know about the comics, it's actually pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
So she seems to be a woman who has these glimpses of this killer, this otherworldly killer, who we know from the comics is a version of his Ezekiel from Spider-Man, and he's going after people, he's murdering people for his own nefarious reasons to trigger something because they're going to become something, and because she has these visions, she can kind of, what seems like, relive the events and try to stop things from happening.
Yeah.
And she ends up rescuing a group of, what, four women? Something like that.
Three other women.
All of whom will end up... I guess they are, what, destined to become these
Spider-Woman
heroes?
Spider-Woman or something
like that. It seems like, if this movie had another name, it would be called, like, Spider-Women.
Yeah.
I think that is what it is, sort of... that is what they are stealth doing with it.
Yeah, yeah.
It's always weird that Spider-Man is not in these stories. But that's been the case since, what, Venom? That's the one that kicked it off.
Yeah.
And in a way, this would give them their heroes. If they want their heroes of this little pocket corner of the Spider-Verse. I wouldn't even call it the Spider-Verse. It's just their thing.
I think it's a good concept. I think, for me, it's in kind of the execution. And I know they want their reveals of their costume characters to be, like, hidden a little bit and not outright show them. I wish we'd seen a little bit more. I thought this
trailer... I almost thought they showed too much of it.
I thought the trailer
was
because
it's going to be a little bit of a shock to audiences to be watching what does look like some kind of thriller with someone who can see the future and is stopping these things from happening. And then suddenly, whoa, superheroes, what?
I guess for me, I I judge superhero movies now against the MCU.
Right, but you also want them to all be like the MCU. This, like you didn't like the Shyamalan stuff as much as I did. Unbreakable.
I didn't. I liked it okay though. I mean, yeah. That's the thing. This against the standards of it, like the 90s or early 2000s, this looks solid enough. Against the standards that's been set since 2008, it doesn't look right to me. It's like, you guys can do superhero movies. Why are you doing this?
And I think that's where what you are looking for is the Marvel-style superhero movie. Mm-hmm. And I think you have to allow room for stuff that is like, say, you know, like the Christopher Nolan. Who's the guy who did the X-Men movies?
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Vaughn, Bryan Singer.
No, it's Bryan Singer. Like the Bryan Singer X-Men stuff. Although I would want those done differently now, too. I think they still work pretty well as movies. And I think, like, that kind of approach, or even Shyamalan's Unbreakable and Split and Glass style, like, it's just a different kind of format. Sometimes it does look like a little retro 90s.
But
I
agree,
won't deny.
The fact that these are Marvel characters,
yeah.
But
that's almost irrelevant to it. Sony isn't playing that up.
And that's my problem with it. It is irrelevant to it. And I'm like, I understand reinterpretation. I'm all for reinterpretation.
Yep.
But reinterpreting them as a less interesting version, which is what this looks like to me, I don't understand it.
Yeah. What they are trying to do, I think, anyway, is get general audience with them while retaining enough comic people who are just there for the name value. Venom was close enough. Morbius is more of a concept than anything else. What else do they have coming up?
Kraven.
Yeah, I've known comic fans and general audience people who thought the Kraven trailer looked cool. We thought it looked goofy.
I thought it looked goofy, but I thought it was a better put together trailer than this.
Oh, I disagree. I'd say this is better than Kraven's trailer.
Oh, really?
And I'd say they're about on the same level. I think they were both solidly done for general audiences and only seem really weird to us because we have a set of expectations.
I guess I just came off of Spider-Man 2.
Yep.
Which has a perfect Kraven and
Spider-Man 2 the video game.
And that's the thing, like, these characters, there's an Avengers Tower, like, Easter egg,
mm-hmm.
but that is not that is a Sony game,
mm-hmm.
it is not in the Marvel Universe, but it still feels like Spider-Man's universe.
Yeah.
This doesn't feel like Spider-Man's universe.
And it's not trying to be, though.
And I think it should be.
Like,
I think
there must be a business decision, like, Sony knows that they might end up selling the Spider-Man to, Marvel?
Why not do an Andrew Garfield Spider-Man movie again after the success of No Way Home that is a Sony? Like, why not do that to launch Madam Web?
I mean, there's a lot of... essentially, that's all behind-the-scenes stuff that I have no idea about.
But
this was in place well before the success of Spider-Man No Way Home.
I guess.
And so they were doing all these... I think Sony... I mean, I do think this is a possibly insane idea, but they wanted to build their universe... That is not reliant on Spider-Man, but keys off of the success of his.
So I had to look at the director of this, and this will probably inform a little bit on kind of quality level.
Mm-hmm.
This is the same director that did the Defenders Netflix miniseries and part of Jessica Jones. Mm. And I'm like, that's about the level of what this trailer was to me. I don't think that's a bad thing. It's just not
don't
something...
Don't
you? Well, no, no, because I can sit here and say that there were moments from Morbius that I liked.
Yeah.
And I thought the action sequences were good. They were well thought out. I think the Kraven is going to have good action sequences. I think all of these movies, I can find something to like. I will watch all of these movies just because I am a superhero. Just press play. Doesn't matter. But I think... I'm a little bit more with Randy on this that I wish that they weren't, as a fan, and as a known quality of these characters, I wish they weren't squandering them a little bit thing.
But, like, Madam Web is not a character that is being squandered because she's not really a character that anybody knows about.
But the MCU Studios has shown time and time again that they've taken lesser-known characters and made them... a powerhouse. Rocket Raccoon was not somebody that people sought after.
But he's somebody people come into the store looking for. There's a version of this that I would have liked. It doesn't have to have Spider-Man. It could have been this movie. There's a version of this that works. This version doesn't look like it.
I'll say Rocket Raccoon still has the tapestry of the MCU, which has these extremely popular characters to anchor it.
But there are more people who are fans of Rocket Raccoon than they were when... A Rocket Raccoon comic existed.
Sure, sure.
What drives me a little crazy is that the stuff that Sony has announced, The stuff that's actually gotten made is the least interesting stuff. They were going to do a Silver Sable Black Cat movie.
That sounded cool.
That sounded cool, and that didn't happen. They were going to do a Sinister Six movie with Drew Goddard.
Yeah.
That... And I'm like, you know what? That's weird, but I'd watch that. This, they keep, the ones that least interest me keep making it through their pipeline. And I think that's what it is. You're not wrong, David. It is, like, what interests me. Mm-hmm. That is where my interests lie. But I was like, I'm just like, you guys have this, you have a huge catalog of really good characters, and you keep making these mediocre movies.
But I also do say, on the contrary, I do want female-led
sure, that is movies. The only, that is the only good thing about this.
See, I think the trailer, here's the thing, I think it's probably going to end up being like a 2.5 to maybe, on my 5-star movie scale, this will probably end up being in the 2.5 to 3-star yeah. area for me. I think the trailer on its own stands solidly, and that if we didn't have the expectations we bring to it of Marvel stuff, that we would be like, oh, that's kind of looks like an interesting weird thriller with some superhero
and
elements.
And it's interesting because I've had a couple people message me that were very excited about this, I was like, oh, okay, there are people who want to see this.
But and also, I think like although yes, it's weird that Spider-Man's not in it. I'm like, that's old news. We've known that for years and years now. Over it.
That's not even my biggest complaint, though. I'm okay with them not putting Spider-Man in these things. I understand why they're doing it.
I'm weirded out because they own the rights.
I think it's dumb, but I understand it.
No, y'all are still clearly hung up on it.
I just think it's dumb.
But that's where we are. You're right. Realistically, that's where we are.
And I bet there's going to be an Easter egg. Show up or something.
Something. But it doesn't matter. The thing is, as a standalone movie, this doesn't look good to me.
Yeah,
but you know, there whatever.
And I'm the guy who will press play.
It's fine. You'll watch it.
I'll watch it.
I haven't seen Morbius. I haven't seen Venom. I'm not going to see this. I'm not going to see Kraven. I'll see whatever Spider-Man.
I think
movies.
You should press play on Venom at some point. I think...
would not like Venom. I know for sure I'm not going to like Venom. I've seen enough of it. I don't like the character that much. Mm. I've seen enough of it to know that I enjoyed him being an Easter egg in No Way Home. That was about as far as my interest in. It's kind of like Deadpool. I can recognize that it's solidly done, but I don't want to see it.
Okay.
Yeah. That said, I will see Deadpool 3 out of all the movies that are getting made for Marvel next year.
It's the only
one. It's Kraven, Madame Web, and Deadpool 3.
Randy will always show up to support Deadpool.
I think I looked at the movie slate for next year. Yeah. I think there's only 3 or 4 superhero movies.
It's rough.
Completely. Out of all things.
People got what they wanted.
Well, I think because Marvel's taking a year off, essentially.
Well, everybody did, because
I don't think it's like, they couldn't come to terms quicker.
Mm-hmm. But I ultimately think strike. It might be a good thing. It'll give people a little bit of a break in superhero, and people complaining about fatigue.
It could be. They'll be like, oh, we could live without these.
Yep.
I think it's shown... that it's got enough of the pulse.
I was excited about Marvel's when they announced their plans. I was excited about them, and now it seems very clear we're not going to get those plans.
Well,
what plans?
The Kang War, Secret Wars, all that.
That's because
plague,
of like,
all that
real
stuff.
Life.
There's all kinds of stuff. Yeah, but as a result of the Marvel's commercial failure, some other things, I think they're going to completely change what the plan was.
I think so too.
And I hope that the new plan also still interests me. It probably will, because I'm a huge sucker for the Marvel Universe.
I feel like we've seen some behind-the-scenes shakeups with, like, not only actors, but also a few writers and things.
As long as Feige doesn't leave. As long as they don't leave Kevin Feige.
I don't think that's the thing. And, I don't... there's still some stuff in the pipeline.
But it's a thing I like, and I don't like it being this unstable. It's making me nervous.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, it is the year of instability,
yep.
Or years.
Well, we'll have What If, we'll have Echo, and we'll have.
Yep.
I'm excited for Echo. I the smaller streets level stuff is fun.
Echo looks fine. It's more like Netflix Marvel, which is not my favorite Marvel, but I'm sure it'll be good.
It, you never know. Good surprise.
It could. All right, let's take a break, and we're gonna come back and talk about some TV and movies and a bunch of board games if we have time.
I don't think we have time.
So, Nick, you and I want to talk about Monarch Legacy of Monsters.
Correct.
Which is the Apple Plus series tying into Godzilla and Kong and all that kind of stuff.
The Legacy Monster Universe, I think, is what they're calling it.
I liked this trailer.
Monarch is like the shield of those movies.
Monarch is the most interesting. Of the three movies, Kong Skull Island, Godzilla vs. Kong, and Godzilla,
yeah.
Monarch is the thing that always had my interest. And here, they never did that much. And this is all focused on Monarch.
Here they're... This is kind of like the more sinister Monarch.
They are a little... They're a secret government organization that is trying to keep the nature of the Titans secret.
Which is interesting because this is like... This is like a prequel to some of the movies, because this mm-hmm. takes place in 2015, mm-hmm. and then in 1960, is that correct?
1952 and 1959.
1952 and 59.
Some of those movies, by the way, have like show like massive things that they've
constructed,
right? But
the only thing that has happened is Godzilla has attacked San Francisco.
Yeah.
Okay.
That is the only monster attack
that has
happened.
I was going to say, they must have quite the budget.
Well, they really don't show a ton of monsters. Like, they show Godzilla.
Yep.
But I think that footage might be from the movie, or is it not?
I think it's... I don't think it is, because they may have used part of it, but then reshot, like, some of the bridge sequence, because one of the main characters, our female lead in a lot of ways, is kind of...
What I like about this is all the characters I've enjoyed, it's the Japanese guy, the guy with two families.
Yes.
Is that...
I don't think that's supposed to be Ken Watanabe.
It's not Watanabe's character.
I don't think so.
Okay, I thought it might be.
I think it is very much, it kind of feels that way, but I don't think it is.
But they also tie him into, isn't W.R., what's his name, isn't that John Goodman's character?
It is. That is the young version of John Goodman.
So we see a young version of John Goodman's character from Skull Island. We also see
it opens with John Goodman.
We open with John Goodman being attacked by monsters on the island, and he's throwing a package into the sea that's got a message to his son.
Yeah, it's basically a backup of all the files he has kind of collated about the
and
the
then it is
Mutos.
It is found by this mysterious Japanese man who we found out later has two families.
Correct.
Two families, like he's like deceiving
one in Japan and
one
in
Japan and one in America. And they find out after he's died or disappeared or whatever, his daughter
comes to Japan to sort of kind of they find out he has an apartment there and. Yeah. Gonna like finalize, like close things down, and then
in the apartment there's an old Japanese woman and her and
son
and a boy her age, mm-hmm. and yes, it turns out that this guy had a separate family.
Okay,
and so she and the half brother,
yep,
go to his hacker ex girlfriend, who I love that character,
yep, great character,
and they find some stuff in her dad's safe in her dad's office. There's like old school videotapes and that kind of thing that has Monarch stuff,
mm-hmm.
which sends up a flag, which runs it through a internet decryption program, sends up a flag to Monarch, and so now Monarch is on their trail.
Okay.
Meanwhile, there's a I love they're jumping around in time.
Yeah,
they do some really clever stuff.
There's even a flashback within their past thing, and I'm like, that's crazy. I don't think I've seen that before.
Because it's 1959 and then back to 1952.
First episode that is very complex,
mm-hmm.
and I've at first was like, is this too much? Is this too much for people to really kind of like, but it's
pretty, even the genre drops, it's pretty straightforward.
It is, and I think it like really comes together. The other big stuff we haven't, like we were about to say, the 1950 or that era, we get to meet Wyatt Russell. Which is
playing, what's his full name? It's like something the third.
Yeah,
they call him Lee.
Basically, he's a military operator who is working with the John Goodman character and a woman scientist who get introduced to the Mutos.
Yeah, they're looking for the Mutos, and they find
and there's a really cool sequence with a giant. Bat creature.
Yeah.
And
it's not the bat creature from Justice League Godzilla.
It might actually be.
Okay.
But the sequence there and kind of the location
is really, really cool. That was really
the
good.
The tie to John Goodman's character I thought was really well done and really kind of it punched. It was a really good thing.
Also, they did some great setup with that lead character where it's like we had seen her in like a photo and all this stuff, and then they looks like they may have killed her off.
It's possible,
not sure.
But then it jumps back.
It looks
and then
pretty definitive.
It does. I thought the effects were good.
The effects are really good.
The
characters are all really interesting.
These aren't one-note characters. I mean, they basically are doing kind of like familial relationships and like a woman, and then dealing with
you
like
know, some
giant
of the
monsters attack and how people have kind of capitalized on.
There's some great stuff. There's a cabbie in Japan. The woman from San Francisco, the K, what's her name? The lead character.
Yeah.
So she gets there, and she gets in the cab, and the cabbie's like, she's looking around, she sees all these shelters for Godzilla and this kind of thing, uh-huh. and he's like, it's all a conspiracy, Godzilla isn't real, that San Francisco attack never happened. And then they show a flashback to her, she was a school teacher on a bridge. They kill a bus full of kids.
They do.
Like, they went hard on this.
That's interesting. I don't think the movies tend to do that too much, so, like, except Kong.
She's trying to get these kids off the bus, and the bus plummets into the water.
She's, like, dealing with PTSD, but it's interesting
but
how...
This guy's telling her...
It sounds like it's got elements of... who made Rogue One in the first Godzilla movie?
Gareth Edwards.
He did that movie Monsters, which is what got him the Godzilla gig, which was like an indie kaiju movie that kind of focused on the impact of the, you know, those kind of creatures in the everyday world.
Yeah, they have shelters in Japan with...
That was what interested... Like, I didn't love that movie, but those parts were the most interesting parts.
Yeah, they have shelters where... And they run sirens, which they do drills and that kind of thing, where basically everybody evacuates these shelters in case there's a Godzilla attack.
Yeah.
There's some really cool ideas in this.
The world building is really interesting and really just tying... It is kind of doing a tying all the movies together into one thing.
It made me want to rewatch these movies, even though I know I didn't love any of them.
Right, but you might actually get that some of that shared universe energy of knowing, oh, this leads to this, or this person
ties to this. I don't know if I can highly recommend it, but when I went in and saw the original Godzilla that had Bryan Cranston and Juliette Binoche, I think I had expectations of it just being a Godzilla movie.
Right.
And when you kind of show this and where the human element is actually done well... as opposed to something, say, like Transformers, where the human element is the bullshit.
Right.
I think that Godzilla, the 2014 Godzilla movie, works so much better.
Yeah, I can see that.
Because I've gone back and rewatched that one, and I actually think it's a really good movie.
Well, the Monarch, this is what I always wanted, was more of the Monarch stuff, and it delivers on what I wanted it to be.
There's a new episode hitting, I think, tomorrow, or maybe tonight.
I think that might be right,
And I'm excited for it. Weirdly, my wife thought the first two episodes were great.
Also, it's kind of fun. Wyatt Russell and Kurt Russell are playing the same character just 50 years apart.
Yeah, it's a really fun idea. And I think this may be Kurt Russell's first, like, television in, like, 50 ever. Years? 60 years? No, he did, like, Disney stuff.
Yeah, like Gunsmoke or something.
His role in this, where basically they find him in, like, a retirement home, and he's basically being kept prisoner by Monarch.
Yeah,
and he's like, look, we got 60 seconds. You want to go or stay or go?
It was
like, it was a very cool. They're definitely letting him be the cool guy.
Yeah, and that's what he plays. Like, it's a very fun but very good show.
Yeah, I greatly enjoyed it.
You know, we were talking about, like, there's some other genres that have been possibly coming to TV, like Alien at some point is going to get its TV show.
Yep,
and I forget what the other one was. And several of them, I remember my thought was, I'm like, I don't want any more Alien movies. I'm done with them. But I'm like, as a TV show, I could have an interest because you can do the kind of long-form storytelling and you could find some stuff. And it sounds like this is kind of one of those ones, at least from what y'all are saying, I'm going to try and catch it at some point, that's making good use of that.
Yeah, I agree.
Real quick, I want to mention, and I'm going to do a write-up on all this stuff, but I did go to BGGCon this weekend and played about 20 new games. And wanted to give a rundown of sort of stuff that we have at the store. I'm going to do a write-up for the store and that kind of thing. But quick mention a few things I played that I think people would like. We've got a game called World Wonders.
Okay.
That is what they call the polyomino, kind of like Tetris. You put the little spaces down.
Okay.
We're getting that back. We're getting that in this week. I highly recommend it. Basically, every turn you're drafting pieces. You're spending resources to buy pieces that fit on your map.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to use roads to connect the different pieces, and then you build these wonders, a little 3D terrain that's like various civilizations.
Oh, okay.
There's Machu Picchu, there's the pyramids, there's like the Easter Island heads. And when you buy the things, you have to use certain resources, and they have to fit onto your board. And so by the end of the game, you have these very pretty, like, cities you've built.
Mm-hmm.
And you're sort of competing with other people to try and build stuff. So, like, if you're chasing a wonder, you might buy the right kind of building you need, and then they might build the wonder, and then you have to build something else.
Oh, that sounds cool. Sounds like a combination of a bunch of different, like, board games, like Carcassonne meets...
Well, it was really... It's a really easy game to play, and I think it has got a lot of strategy. I played it twice and really enjoyed it.
Is it, like, a quick play one, or is it more...
It maybe 45 minutes to an hour.
Okay, so, just standard. Cool.
Really nice production values. Empire's End, which we kickstarted.
Mm-hmm.
This is from the designer of Space Base, which is a game I really like. This is a game where it's sort of the Roman Empire. You all have your own civilizations, and you start with all your buildings are built. And then every turn, disaster cards come up, and you sort of bid not to get them. You bid resources to not get the, and you go in rounds, you bid resources, and if you are, you can either take them so you get those resources, or if you're stuck, you cannot pay the resource, you have to take it. And the disaster kills one of the parts of your board, but you get the resources from it. And you also get an upgrade that goes to one of your other boards. And basically you're trying to have the least destroyed civilization by the end of the game.
Okay.
The things like plague and volcano and all that stuff are represented.
What's the game called?
Called Empire's End.
Okay.
Very clever, and anyone who likes like Space Base or Machikoro or that kind of thing would probably dig this kind of game.
Okay.
Game called Diced Veggies, where you put dice. There are multiple colors that represent mushrooms, carrots, tomatoes, peppers, and something else.
Onions?
Maybe onions. I think onions is the other one. And then you have recipe cards that you get. And each turn, you can have up to two recipes in front of you. And you get two like cards that are like... you might have like... Your card might be, a shepherd's pie.
Mm-hmm.
And the modifier might you have is to die for. Or to remember. And basically, you have to spend different dice to build these things.
Oh.
And you build until someone has built six recipes, then you count up points. The kind of neat thing is you roll the dice, and then you have to use a little cleaver to chop the dice away to get them. it's a neat little quick game.
Yeah, this sounds very fun, and especially if you have like a foodie in your life,
yeah.
This might be something that they will have a lot of interest
in
playing.
I enjoyed this one, and I thought it was a good like between games game. It plays in like 10-15 minutes.
Okay.
Flip Town, which we also just got, is what they call a flip and write, which is a version of the Roll and Write. Basically, everybody has a board. It represents a Western town, and you play three poker cards face up, and everybody can choose from that, from the suits and the numbers. The suit tells you what part of the town you go to, whether you go to the trail, the mine, the robberies, or the town.
Okay.
And then you get the numbers tell you where in there you go. The trail is like you get a bunch, you can explore and get a bunch of points, that kind of thing. The robberies are you can rob everything from chicken rustling all the way up to train robberies.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And then you draw a card to see if you're successful. If you're not successful, you get all the wanted and half of the victory points, but none of the money.
Do you move around to different territory on each turn?
Each turn you choose which territory you're going to.
Okay.
And you also are picking whatever you pick. Say if you take the King of Spades that gets you to the robberies and a train or whatever like that. That goes in your little poker hand. At the end of the round, you have five cards, and you get resources depending on what poker hand you build.
Oh, wow. So you actually, the poker hands
actually
relevant.
Are the thing you build, yeah. And then at the end of three turns, you see who won.
That sounds pretty clever, actually. Is
this also a quick play game?
I would say 30 to 45 minutes.
Okay.
And it's super fun. It goes up to four players. I played it twice, once learning it and once teaching it, and had a great time with it. And it's a cheap game. I think it's like $25-$30. It's like a cheap game. Played the White Castle, which we have, which is another dice game where you are Japanese nobles trying to find favor with the daimyo.
This is not a White Castle burger game.
It is not a White Castle burger game. You have these little 3D 3D bridges with three different colors of dice that you roll every turn, and then you take from the end of the bridges to go to the palace or to train your samurai. Or to, I'm trying to think what else, what other stuff. There's all kinds of resources you can get. And by the end of the game, you're trying to get victory points.
Okay.
It's a dice placement game. A lot of fun. Really, really pretty. And a pretty, pretty easy game to learn.
Say the name of that one.
The White Castle.
White Castle, okay, right.
We got Apiary, which I really liked. That is a game where you're playing future space bees.
Right.
Yeah. It is from a new designer, but it's the publisher Stonemaier that did Scythe, Wingspan, all that kind of stuff. Yep. And if you like Scythe and Wingspan, you're going to like this. It's got the same sort of resource building, the same sort of learning curve, and there's a lot of things you can do on this board, but once you learn it, it's pretty straightforward.
Yeah, I remember those are games that have, like Scythe, I remember being rather intimidating to look at.
Yeah.
But, like, one playthrough and you kind of got it down, and it's cool to see the different paths to victory that these kind of games tend to do. Is it one of those, did you say?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I played Leaf, which we also have a couple of left from Kickstarter edition. Yeah. This is very pretty. It's got these nice little wooden leaves. And basically, you are taking a leaf and trying to hit the tips of that leaf to one of the other leaves. You're sort of building a tree structure.
Oh.
And when you do that, you get animal cards, and more leaf cards to play, and you move your little squirrel up on the tree, and whoever's highest on the tree gets points, and you put mushrooms out there, and whoever's mushrooms gets points, and you get animals, and then there's three freezes, and during the freeze you can hibernate your animals, and you get points for your biggest sets of animals. Really neat little game, and very, very pretty.
Okay.
And the last one I want to mention is Kutnahora, okay. Which means City of Silver.
Okay.
This is a real city in Czechoslovakia, maybe?
Okay.
So you are all trying to build this town and collectively build this cathedral. And the town lets you build... So there's a mining aspect, there's a building aspect, and then you are part of three guilds. I think there's five total guilds, and you get three of them, so you can mm-hmm. build buildings from them. But the kind of neat mechanic that I've never seen anywhere else is there's these little these displays that have cards and a little pull tab on them mm-hmm. that give you the current price for food, beer, mm-hmm. silver, ore, and permits.
Okay.
And they change.
Yep. So you may the market fluctuates.
And wood. Wood is the thing you construct. So if you want to build a building, you pay a certain amount of wood, and you pay based on what that slider tells you it's currently worth.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're the wood guild, you want that price to be high, because then when you get your income, you get lots of money.
Right.
But if you're building, you want it to be low. So if you build something that produces wood, it creates a more supply, and therefore the price goes down, because now there's more of it. So when, like, you level up... I was playing the food guild, and I built this big food building, and I'm like, oh, I'm going to suddenly get, like, five more food units. But because the price of food went down, it was almost a wash in terms of what resources I got.
It's an intense economic game.
It was very cool, and it sounds more complicated than it is. It's actually right. very straightforward.
Now let me quick ask. You said you're kind of mutually building a cathedral.
Yes.
But this is not a cooperative game.
No. You are competing for points.
Yeah.
But you do choose to do... Like, if you build part of the cathedral... The next level of the cathedral gives you different things when you build it.
Yeah, yeah.
And the other players get that. And someone might be like, oh, I was trying to get that, and it's gone now. So it's not like directly competitive. You can't destroy other people's buildings or anything.
Right.
But you can
cut off their avenues.
You can take spots in the mines that they might want. You can take spots in the city that you might want, that kind of thing. This was really good. It is on pre-order. I believe it's going to be here mid-December. And I'm super excited about this game. I thought it was super fun. I think anybody who likes Carcassonne and that kind of thing would definitely enjoy this.
I know you just gave a rundown, but did you have a favorite game that you played?
World Wonders was my favorite thing I played.
Okay.
We're getting that in. I'm definitely going to get a copy for myself.
Very cool.
But yeah, I'm going to do a write-up and write my top favorites and stuff we've got and that kind of thing. But of the ones we got, I would say the ones that we have right now, World Wonders, Empire's End, Flip Town, and Apiary are the ones you really want to like look out for. We've got all those in stock, and they're all really, really good. If you've got a game in your life you want a Christmas present for, and this is stuff that's all pretty new,
yeah,
I would definitely check those out.
That's awesome.
All right. That is our super fast podcast for the week. I think we'll be back next week with more. Until that time...
Have a good Thanksgiving, and Yo, Joe!
Roguecast is a weekly podcast broadcast from Rogues Gallery Comics and Games in Round Rock, Texas. You can find us online on Facebook and at www.roguesgallerytx.com and email us comments or questions at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.